On This Week in Enterprise Tech, big data gets into big flash. The FCC wants you to know that, no, the internet has not ended because of net neutrality. And everything you wanted to know about enterprise patching, but was afraid to ask. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 183, recorded March 21st, 2016, for April 1st, 2016. Enterprise Patch Fatigue. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/Twyatt. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And I'm joined by two of my favorite people in the universe, starting with Mr. Brian Cheehy. He's the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, welcome back after a little bit of excitement on your campus this past week.
Too much excitement.
Yeah, bad things.
Yeah, we're still cleaning up, and the lawyers are in full force.
Also joining us is Curtis Franklin, who's hopefully recovered from all the Enterprise Connect goodness in Orlando, Florida. Curtis, how are you, my friend?
Doing well, Padre. Recovered from Enterprise Connect and on my way to preparing for Interop. It's just one great show after another.
Well, gentlemen, we do have a great show for you. Not only are we going to be doing our regular blips and bites, but we've also got Lane Thames, who's going to be coming on to talk about the issues of patching in the enterprise. It's a must-watch Twyatt. But first, let's go ahead and jump straight into the blips. This first one is all about big flash getting into big data. Now, there was a time when uber high-performance all-flash arrays, like those from IO Fusion or Violin Memory, were super specialized deployments for high IO mission-critical applications. Well, those times are gone. And flash arrays are finding their way down into medium-sized enterprises as a regular part of ops. 2 weeks ago, Pure Storage announced that it was customizing its arrays to provide large-scale analytic engines while simultaneously dropping their price points to reach out to enterprises that had not previously been able to justify a Pure Flash array. Pure Storage's FlashBlade platform provides 1.6 petabytes of Pure Flash storage in a 4U rack unit, connected to other nodes via 40 gig Ethernet for high-speed, high I/O storage, designed for big data analysis of everything from social media trends to air tunnel fluid dynamics. While flash storage has been used for big data analytics in the past, Pure Storage is blazing a trail for Pure Flash, not SSD, flash systems that are optimized for large disparate data sets.
The FTC says Silver Push goes too far. The FTC has issued a warning to a handful of Google Android application developers after it emerged that they were using Silverpush, controversial software that turns on an Android device's microphone without the user's knowledge and can pick up background sounds to better target advertisers. The functionality is designed to run silently in the background even while the user is not actively using the application. Now, one way that developers use Silverpush is to check for TV commercials being heard to verify listening patterns. For enterprise users, though, Silverpush represents exactly the sort of security issue that we've all been afraid would appear.
A new lip sync program is going to confuse you even more with live video overlays. Video evidence is going to get much less credible as face-to-face emerges from the laboratory at Stanford's Max Planck Institute. The prototype allows you to capture video footage of just about anyone and overlay your lip movements over another video. So, for instance, you could change what Donald Trump said at a news conference to, well, anything. Talk about technology that has great potential for good and evil.
Is the era of third-party firmware over. TP-Link is officially the first major networking hardware vendor to announce that it will lock out third-party firmware on its consumer and SMB router products in order to abide by new FCC regulations. The regulations are an attempt to prevent the radios and Wi-Fi-equipped routers from operating outside their RF parameters, and the FCC has made it clear several times that it is not intending to ban third-party firmware like the popular DDWRT and OpenWRT, but unfortunately it seems that such a ban is unavoidable. The contentious issue lies in the FCC requirements that any firmware has controls to prevent devices from deviating from approved frequencies, power levels, signaling, and modulation. Unfortunately, the open source nature of DDWRT and OpenWRT make it next to impossible to comply with the FCC requirements while still giving users the power they've come to expect from WRT-enabled routers. The changes will be incorporated into devices produced on or after June 2, 2016, which is the FCC deadline for compliance. The TP-Link FAQs, however, seem to hint at workarounds to the ban. But as we approach summer, expect more router manufacturers to lock down their gear.
IBM buys Optivia for SaaS and CRM. IBM has announced the acquisition of Optivia, a software-as-a-service systems integrator specializing in Microsoft Dynamics CRM solutions for public sector organizations. The private company's main focus is on UK emergency services, central government, local governments, health authorities, and housing and social enterprises. Now, news of this acquisition follows reports that IBM has started laying off workers as part of a workforce rebalancing, which financial analyst firm Bernstein has estimated could affect 14,000 workers. For Big Blue, the rebalancing looks like it will include much more power in the European government market.
I'd like to buy a snowblower in hell for my apartment because Obama says Google is going to Cuba. In yet another Obama bombshell in the first U.S. presidential visit to Cuba since 1928, apparently part of the conversation was about Google possibly opening up internet services in an area that currently only has a 5% internet services penetration. The world is changing, and I never expected to see the end of the U.S. trade embargo to Cuba in my lifetime.
Hey, remember when unbundling Windows from a Dell PC was annoying at best, downright Kafka-esque at worst? Well, no more. Dell's Project Sputnik laptops that come with Ubuntu Linux pre-installed have not only survived, but thrived at the kinder, gentler, Linux-friendlier Dell. Project Sputnik, dreamed up by senior principal engineer at the office of the Dell CTO, Barton George, was initially created to offer Linux-powered touchscreens, Ultrabook-style computing to the product line. Since its inception in 2012, Sputnik has become the poster child of open-source community efforts to develop tools, drivers, and software that make non-developer Linux PCs a reality. The latest announcement centers around the Sputnikization of Dell's popular XPS 13 line, which will push the boundaries of ultra-high-resolution touchscreen support for Ubuntu. For the diehard FOSS fans out there, Dell upstreams many of their developments back into the Linux kernel, leading to performance and OS equality for all. That does it for our blips. Let's go ahead and jump straight into the bites. Gentlemen, I know that we didn't want to bring up this topic again this quickly, but unfortunately, it's back in the news. The FCC net neutrality opponents have a little bit of pie on their face after FCC Chairman Wheeler basically called them out at a function in Washington, D.C., saying, "So, how's that end-of-the-world scenario working out for you?" Now, it was a little more than a year ago that the FCC voted the open internet order into being. If you remember a year ago, you'll recall critics saying that the order would, and I'm going to quote here, devastate investment to infrastructure, be the cause of a complete halt of network rollouts, and this one was kind of puzzling, be the end of consumer privacy on the internet. Well, that last week, Tom Wheeler, chairman of the FCC, trotted out a few numbers for the year of doom and gloom of the internet at a conference in D.C. And among those highlights, first, AT&T, one of the loudest critics of the order, who threatened to completely halt their network rollout, actually increased their yearly investment by $2 billion to $22 billion. Comcast, which didn't threat a halt but was a very firm supporter of the anti-net neutrality lobby, has also committed to increasing network infrastructure expenditures in 2016. The open internet rules have actually increased network usage, which in turn has increased revenue per user at both Comcast and AT&T. And the invocation of Title II, rather than destroying customer privacy, has allowed the FCC to force telcos to adopt common privacy rules that allow subscribers to opt in to how their data is being used. In other words, the completely unsubstantiated FUD that the telcos were spreading turned out to be completely unsubstantiated FUD. I want to throw over to you first, Curtis, because, I mean, this is something that we've come to expect. Yes, there was a lot of FUD. There was a lot of fear-mongering. There was a lot of the opponents of net neutrality who are basically saying, you can't do this. It's going to destroy the industry. It's going to destroy the internet. And not only has that not come true, but it turns out the order has actually been good for business. Did we expect this?
Well, I think that the proponents of network neutrality expected it and said that this was what was going to happen. You know, these companies that had been screaming gloom and doom are acting rationally on an economic basis and are continuing to develop their infrastructure. We know how the games are played in lobbying. You know that the opponents of anything are going to come out with the direst possible prediction, and they're rarely, if ever, completely realized. So I don't think there's anything surprising in either the language that was used to oppose network neutrality or the fact that those worst-case scenarios are the farthest thing from what's actually happened.
Chira, one of the hallmarks of the debate was AT&T standing up in the halls of Congress and saying, we promise you that if you pass this open internet order, we will halt the rollout, the promised rollout, to millions and millions of subscribers that they only promised after the FCC announced that they were starting to consider net neutrality regulations. And then the FCC came back and said, okay, go ahead, stop. And it was sort of like, and by the way, you do remember that you promised to do those rollouts in order to get this other buyout that we allowed you to get. I almost want to ask, should there be a penalty phase for the companies that really, really tried to lie in order to make this not happen?
I would love to see it, but I'm getting, I hear the Twilight Zone music in the background because I could have sworn I heard these exact speeches, these exact rants in front of Congress when we were deregulating the interlata telephony market, which led to cell phones, which led to voice over IP, which led to a bonanza of new services that AT&T and folks said, no, it's going to be the end of Western civilization. We're going to have to cut off everybody's telephone service. Yeah, I'm getting a real bad case of deja vu here. So, yeah, I'm sorry. The FCC is totally right to do an I told you so. And to Tom Wheeler, I say it's time for you to get up in front of AT&T and so forth and say, nanny, nanny, boo, boo.
Okay, maybe not with the nanny, nanny, boo, boo, but I understand the sentiment. But Chibert, okay, obviously Wheeler wants to take this, the success of the open internet order. And by success, I mean the non-failure of the open internet order and parlay that into future policy. The policy that they're really pushing right now is what telcos can and cannot do with consumer data. He's got a preliminary agreement with the telcos on having customers opt in to how their data gets used, but he wants something even stricter. Is this something that he can capitalize on? Can he use this to say, well, I know that you don't want us to do this, but you also said that the open internet order was going to be a disaster, and that wasn't. So obviously you should listen to us rather than them.
Yeah, I want Tom Wheeler to do this. I want him to keep the internet service providers more honest. I would like to have a little bit more control over what they do with my private data. Will it happen? I don't know. Get out your dice and roll it, because I think it's a dice roll at this point.
All right. Curtis, let's step back a little bit, because I do want to represent the other side. Because we did not just have FUD mongers. It wasn't just AT&T and Comcast and Verizon and Sprint saying that this was going to destroy the internet as we know it. There were actually some local operators. Specifically, in the Twit Army, we had a Wi-Fi, a wireless operator who was saying, yeah, these rules are going to hurt me. have there been any noticeable ill effects of the open internet order? Because you write about this all the time. Can you reach back into your journalist satchel for the last year and give me an example of where it didn't turn out right or it had an unintended consequence?
There are none that I covered and none that I recall seeing. But let me say now, it is entirely possible that there have been some of these smaller operators who have had trouble on an individual basis. I'm entirely ready to be convinced that that's the case. But the real issue is whether for the vast majority of the market, has this been a good thing or a bad thing? And I think the evidence is that it's been a good thing. Now, I'm sure that there will still be people who say, well, yes, the sky is not falling and people are investing. But just imagine how much investment we would have had by now if these rules had not been put in place. And since it's impossible to prove a negative, we'll never know. I will say, too, that we're about to see this game played out once more in the set-top box unlocking. We're already seeing the articles come out. I've seen, for example, op-ed pieces in the Wall Street Journal saying that if the FCC requires companies to unlock the set-top box market, it will be the end of cable television as we know it. No longer will we be able to watch Game of Thrones. We'll all be forced back into watching three networks plus PBS. The hyped up language goes on and on. It's just the particular axe being ground that changes.
Right, right. And actually very good point about that because the battle continues. It just moves fronts. So go figure. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for that. We will have to come back to net neutrality at some point in the near future. I am sorry, but it is coming back up again and again and again. And there are a few lawsuits that are actually coming to a head that we'll need to cover. But for now, let's forget that because we're going to be bringing in our guest in just a bit. If you've ever wanted to find out what were the issues of patching at an enterprise, well, you're going to want to listen to our guest for this week of This Week in Enterprise Tech. But before we do that, let's go ahead and thank the sponsor of this episode, and it's ZipRecruiter. Now, are you hiring or are you responsible for the hiring at your company? If so, then you understand that the people that you hire, the talent that you bring in, they're going to determine the success or failure of your business. They will have the next big idea. They will have the passion that drives you. They will have the energy that makes you the company that you think you can be. Now, if you are that person, you also understand that posting one place is not enough. It's just simply doesn't have the volume to get you the number of quality candidates that you need to select the right one. And not just the one with the right skill set, but the one with the right personality. The one who fits into the culture of your company. The one who will be the one. Well, with ZipRecruiter.com, you can find the best candidate fast because they understand that posting jobs in one place isn't enough. That's why with a single click, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter. You can find candidates in any city or industry or, you know, across the nation. You can post just once, and then you get to watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. There are no juggling of emails or calls to your office. There's no round-robin of unsuitable candidates. ZipRecruiter only gives you the very best ones. You can screen, rate, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. The people you hire are so important to the success of your business. Do you really want to leave that up to chance? Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Twiat. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Twiat. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's time for my favorite part of the show where we welcome our guest. Today, it's Lane Thames. He is a security research and software development engineer at Tripwire. Lane, thank you very much for coming onto the show.
Thanks for having me, Padre.
Now, for the folks who maybe haven't seen your company being represented on Twiat before, what is Tripwire?
Well, we're a security company, cybersecurity company. We work within the vulnerability management space, configuration compliance, log management, file integrity management. Those are our core products.
Okay, and you know, I know that you've been represented here on TWiET before. It's really across the security spectrum, right?
I'm sorry?
TWiPRO is pretty much across the security spectrum, yes?
Yes, pretty much, yes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We were actually recently acquired by a company called Belden, and who is in the industrial IT space, so we're even branching further.
Right, right. Now, you have come onto the show specifically today to talk about the implications of patching in the enterprise. What are some of the things that your research turned up?
Well, the biggest thing is we found that organizations are having a hard time keeping up nowadays. And we had with where I work, I'm in the vulnerability management group, and we have a very intricate interconnection with patching. Vulnerability and management and patch management go hand in hand. And we started seeing issues over time where working with customers and just speaking with other people in the industry, it was like, you know, there seems to be a big issue with people not understanding how to do patching with respect to managing vulnerabilities. And so we just came across, you know, let's try to measure the ecosystem and see how people are handling things. And and sure enough, we found that, you know, organizations are right now barely able to keep their head above water, even when using patch management software or not. That was one interesting finding.
One of the issues that has come up is patch fatigue. When patches come at such a furious rate, and I'm not talking just about Microsoft. I could talk about any company that has enterprise-level software, that it becomes too easy to just not do it or to put it on an automatic schedule and just forget about it and don't verify that patches have actually been applied. Is this patch fatigue a real thing, or is that just a PR line?
We think it's a real thing. If you think about how the industry is changing, if we look back into, say, 2003, when Microsoft, for example, first started working with Patch Tuesday, the number of endpoints was growing very significantly. The server industry, I would say, fairly stable. Before Linux came out, you know, server systems might have had a long lifespan, IT groups really knew how to manage their systems. But now let's look at it. You know, Linux kind of drove the commodity hardware environments for servers, where you can just throw away servers. And we have a massive open source community. So we have a huge IT asset footprint in terms of the hardware and software devices that are there. And it's getting worse in terms of the mobility market. And now with the Internet of Things, it's, you know, every time you turn around, you're having to install patches, and we really do think it's a real thing.
Right. One of the things about patch fatigue is, and I believe this came out in your study, was that 50% feel that their IT team doesn't actually understand the difference between a patch and a vulnerability remediation. That,
yes.
You know, it's just always assumed, well, we'll just fix that by updating the software rather than fixing that by changing policy or changing user interaction with the system. Does that come up very often? Is that actually a big issue? And is that something that Tripwire helps to remediate?
Yes, it is. We see this quite often. And once again, this is, to kind of explain it further, this is where the interaction between working with patches and working with vulnerability tools, patch management tools and vulnerability management tools, kind of go hand in hand. The patch management tool wouldn't tell you most of the times, hey, you have to, the system is still vulnerable because XYZ steps have not occurred. And when we deal with our customers, many, many times we have to help them understand that, hey, just because you applied the patch, you're still vulnerable, and we're checking for that, and here's what you have to do.
I do want to bring up something a little bit off script here, but there was another security report that I read from a competitor. I won't mention them, but it's, you know, the security field is actually pretty big, who they were really, really concerned about Microsoft's recent attempts to use the patching system, which people have come to trust, to push Windows 10. to the point where they actually pushed the rollout in a required rather than recommended patch. That's one example of a company that abuses its patch trust in order to push software that they want onto a network. Have you seen that a lot? Have you been running into that? Is that a common issue, or is that just unique to Microsoft?
For now, I think we can see it unique to Microsoft.
I got it. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about this other piece of the research that talked about 67% of the time, the people who were polled said that they had difficulty understanding which patch needed to be applied to which system. And this is actually of concern inside of an enterprise, because you probably have Microsoft servers right next to Linux servers, right next to Windows desktops, probably have iOS and OS X devices, as well as Android in the enterprise as well. Does this sort of alphabet soup of patching make it impossible to come up with a coherent patching policy?
It definitely makes it tough, you know, especially when you have large numbers of people. I mean, how do you define a policy when you don't even really know what you need to write a policy for? So it definitely makes it difficult. And, you know, with so many different vendors doing it in so many different ways, that even makes it more complicated.
Right, right. And what would be the wisdom that you would want to give to IT managers who are looking at creating a comprehensive patch policy?
Well, like we stated in our research, you first of all need to recognize that you have a problem. And then the first step is just to sit down and start meeting with your stakeholders, asking questions. You know, how stressful is patch management for your team, for example? Get a feel on training requirements. Do people understand that, for example, is a patch resolving a vulnerability? Because if your team doesn't really understand that, then you're also weakening your security posture. So just starting with some very basic questions and moving into, and then, you know, doing research and figuring out, you know, there's a lot of documentation out there that describes how to actually implement a nice, robust patch management process. Building your systems, building out systems so that you can schedule and test your patches, implementing change management policies, things of that nature.
Actually, let's talk about that first part, the testing of patch rollout. That's something that absolutely should happen, but it doesn't happen enough in enterprises. In fact, I've seen some of my deployments that don't thoroughly test patches across the types of systems that they might see at a 10,000 seat. Is that just wishful thinking, or does that actually happen large scale?
If you have the right tools, you can, and it's a little mixture of art and science to begin with. The difficulty is replicating all of the many configurations you might have. And as an enterprise goes, has scale with many, many systems, the reality of being able to do that diminishes. So a one-to-one testing is never going to happen, but thorough testing can be achieved. For example, you know, especially with virtualization technologies coming online so fast and so abundantly nowadays, you can build duplicated or partially duplicated systems, at least to certain scale. And if you have the right tools, such as, for example, asset the ability to manage your inventory of devices, operating systems, and software, you can, you know, make a better progress moving in that direction.
Right. I want to bring back my co-host on this, because both of them can offer us some unique perspectives on patch fatigue. Chibert, you work at quite possibly the worst of all environments. It's an academic environment / student academic environment / executive environment / policy nightmare environment. What is patching like at such a large institution that actually has individual departments that can set their own security policy?
Well, I'm not going to air my dirty laundry, but there are varying levels of patch diligence at various universities across the nation that I've dealt with. Now, the issue is not everyone has a strong IT group that is able to set policy. And so depending on, you know, colleges or types of university policies, having an internal patch server, a Windows patch server, you know, update server, is a pretty big deal. And being able to go and run a test and then putting it onto the WSA server, the Windows Update server, or something or another, isn't that hard to do anymore. And the Windows Update server is actually very, very inexpensive. In fact, I think it's still free. So there's less and less excuses not to at least have that. And if you're pointing your clients at your own Windows Update server, then that is the biggest step you can make to controlling your patching and updating. Now the other problem is money. You have to have people to test these patches and updates. You have to have people that are competent enough to understand the difference between a vulnerability and an update. This is something that you might actually see in larger, more monolithic organizations like healthcare, finance, and so forth. But in an academic environment, it's pretty much a free-for-all at just about every university I've ever seen until you get into the administration. Anything that touches finance suddenly has a different set of regulations. So, in fact, the only people that I know of that are actually actively running TripLite on their servers are the ones that touch the credit cards. So it's unevenly implemented in the academic world, more so as the organization gets bigger.
Curtis, Chibert's talking about how it's unevenly applied in the academic world, but I do remember you did an Information Week show not too long ago talking about how there's different ways of looking at the IT department. In some institutions, the IT department is a service department. They're part of ops. And so you go to them when you have a problem and they fix your problem. In other organizations, IT is actually part of the executive level. And so they have the power to pass down policy. They can actually affect ops rather than just being an ops support team. Do you still see this distinction? Is there a proper way to implement it and an improper way to implement it so that patching can be done properly?
You do see the distinction. And this is really part of the cultural battle that's going on in IT, because those who want IT to remain part of the executive, where they basically set policy and enforce policy in the entire enterprise, point to things like patch management and update management as one of the reasons why there needs to be strong centralized control. You know, in the classic model, the IT department would test all of the updates that came out, and once every 6 months, or at most probably once a quarter, there would be the update weekend where things wouldn't be available, all the systems would be updated, everyone comes back Monday morning and it's fixed. That was very controlled, and in general, IT would have sandboxed all the updates and patches to make sure that they didn't break anything. Today, with the more distributed model, things get really strange. I mean, IT still enforces the discipline at the core. And interestingly enough, it may enforce some discipline in the mobile devices that are controlled by some sort of MDM package, but it's all the BYOD laptops and the laptops that fall under the control of a department, and most important, all of those cloud services that individual work groups and departments are going out and buying on expense reports, never telling IT about, that get updated infrequently, irregularly, and without any real concern about whether A, they're effective for the situation, or B, they're going to break something in a really spectacular way.
Lane, what about that? So what is, according to you, the proper place of IT? Is it just to support policy, or is it actually to help to create policy in order to make sure that patching and security is handled in the right way?
I believe it has to spread across the spectrum. I'll give you an example. Like if we look at what a CISO does, a Chief Information Security Officer, they need to be able to interface with the underlying IT groups, but they also need to go all the way up to the C-suite level in boardrooms to be able to interface with all of those folks. So I believe there has to be a holistic interface to be effective.
We've got a really good comment in the chat room from Specs, who says, effectively, this is a learning curve struggle for the various internal interests. Would you agree with that statement, Lane? Because it sounds as if IT people need to know that, they're not just supporting tech. They should be helping in creating proper policy. And the executive level needs to understand that they can't just hand edicts on high to IT without actually understanding the issues involved in it.
I would definitely say that we're up against a learning curve. I was reading just last week. I know I used the CISO example just then, but if you go look around, CISO, the actual definition of the job or what it even takes to make it into that position is really undefined right now because we really don't know exactly how to do it. So I would definitely agree that we have a very steep learning curve.
Chibert, I want to pull you back into the debate here. When we start talking about a learning curve, of course, you already gave us the example of what's going on at the university, and thank you very much for not airing your dirty laundry. However, I think you can give us a unique perspective on how it works at a place where, as Spec said, there are various internal interests, a lot of internal interests, each with its own goal, each with its own way of proceeding, that nonetheless need to work together because security at something like a campus, a university campus, is only as good as the weakest department.
Yeah, and the reality is the bulk of the academic environments that I have dealt with, security is more reactionary than anything else. Researchers want to do their research. They don't want to have to be IT people, and not every research group can afford to hire an IT person. So patches may come and go, and I've actually seen some laptops that have come by saying, it's broken, and it hasn't been patched in years, literally. So an academic environment really and truly is the horror story for security. It's almost impossible to keep up. Researchers believe researchers and faculty believe they run the university, so they are the ones that are supposed to be setting the policy. But the IT group wants to set policy, and they can only set policy for certain things, like internet connectivity. Just seeing the change, getting people to no longer use unencrypted logins, that actually was a really big deal for quite a while, and a lot of people just chose to ignore it. So things need to change, and I would love to see some more policy. I'm really sick and tired of having to work on cleaning machines, but I don't see academia changing. So that's the bottom line. Academia is not going to change very quickly, so I think maybe from an external, maybe zoning things out, introducing more departmental level IDS, IPS type of things might be a better answer, at least for now. And maybe as people get more educated and the millennials, grow up and become researchers themselves, and they have grown up in the patch and vulnerability world, maybe the generation has to change.
Elaine, let me ask you about that, because I think Chibert is voicing something that is starting to come up in our chat room here, which is, of course it would be good to have all of this. Of course it would be good to have a multi-pronged approach to security and patching and policy. But that's not reasonable. That's not going to happen. That's pie in the sky. That's a fantasy land. For you, what is the best practical way to do this? What is a way that if a client came to Tripwire and said, we'd like you to review our security policy, you'd be able to give them concrete steps that actually could be implemented in a real-world enterprise?
Sorry, I got caught in my thoughts there. It is a difficult challenge. Yes, the pie in the sky issue is something we would want to achieve. At the end of the day, the best approach is actually user awareness and training. That's where you have to start. If your IT group doesn't understand these issues, then just good training within this realm is definitely a bottom line of where they need to go. In terms of tools, you really are fighting a losing battle if you cannot invest in appropriate tools. So finding the right mix of patch management tools, along with a nice mixture of security tools that can work together. This is where you have to start in order to start making a dent in the patch and security management problem.
Curtis, what about that? So, I mean, trying to make a dent in the patch and security problem and actually bringing it down to real world levels, as Lena suggested, do you see that as realistic? I mean, is that something that will actually be implemented, or something that goes into the best practices document and then gets forgotten for the next 10 years?
I think for a lot of companies, it's going to be one of those things that goes into the best practices document and then is pulled out after a disaster happens, kind of like those really stringent backup policies for every user. But for larger enterprises, I think most of them, for various reasons, really do understand what's necessary here. And I would even say that one of the telltale markers for a lot of organizations is just how much authority the CISO has. You know, if the CISO is someone who reports, say, to the CFO or even to the CEO, then it's much more likely that they're going to be able to enforce the policies required to have rational, repeatable, consistent, and useful patch and update policies. If the CISO is someone who reports to the vice president in charge of Tuesday morning shredder emptying, then it's a problem. And so I think that there are some markers you can use. And what we're waiting for is for the real action to move down from the larger enterprises to those companies that are mid-size but hoping to safely grow.
Very good point, actually. That whole idea of moving policy down into, say, smaller enterprises where things can be implemented with more speed. Cheebert, you actually had a theory about that. The best way to push out security policy is not necessarily from top down, but to go for low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, actually, within my university, I work for the School of Ocean Earth Science and Technology, who has invested through user fees a dedicated IT group, and we actually zone our firewalls, have a full set of crisscrossing IDS, IPSs, things like that, and we're also slowly ramping up trying to get the users to understand that, yes, you do need to patch on a regular basis. Yes, yes, yes. Please stop doing that. Please stop opening up your systems to everybody in the world. It's a long, long road of user education and trying to hit on things that the users are willing to do, because if we keep trying to beat the users over the head with a stick, they're going to revolt. So what we're doing is we're trying, since we are a service organization, well, they are a service organization, you try to cajole, you try to encourage, you try to provide services and best practices when you can. And slowly but surely, especially as we get the ability to work with the kids, you know, try and convince them. As we train them, we try and beat out the bad habits and encourage them to develop better habits on things like, for God's sake, stop using Telnet and FTP. Use encrypted logins. Try and actually turn on the IDS and IPS. Try and make sure everybody's antivirus and anti-malware stuff is up to date. And by the way, the Windows Update Server is free. And if you've got the personnel, why don't you go and do the patches on someone's
quote, sacrificial machine first and find out if anything breaks that really specialized installation of LabVIEW or something like that, and then go and roll it out to your users. So I totally agree with Lane. It is about user education. Unfortunately, in an academic environment, I can't beat them over the head. So we have to encourage them by throwing carrots in front of them.
Actually, that is some research I would love for Tripwire to conduct to find out how many enterprises have the features that Cheaper just talked about, but either don't have them turned on or don't have them configured properly because they just never thought that they'd need them, or they never thought they would work worth the effort to configure them properly. But Lane, I want to give you the last word here. So if you could let our audience go home with one bit of knowledge, one thing to take back to their enterprise, back to their small business, to do policy patching properly, what would it be?
Sit down and understand your environment, your users, the technology that you have, your employees, and just start working on a game plan. If you are currently not working towards a long-term model to mature how you are managing the patches within your environment, then the next 15 years are going to be very, very bumpy. So it's good to just go right now and just start working on a plan and take it from there. It doesn't have to happen tomorrow, but if you start today, in 5 years, who knows where you might be able to be.
We've been speaking to Lane Thames. He is the security research and software development engineer at Tripwire. We want to thank you very much for being part of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, if they want to find out more about Tripwire, more about the research that you publish on a daily basis almost, where should they go?
www.tripwire.com. And on the main page, there are various links. You can go to our blog. We have lots of good social media content, plenty of dummies series, as well as various white papers.
Fantastic. Lane, again, thank you very much for being part of this episode. We'll be sure to have you back when we do a future episode on proper security policy. Well, folks, I'm sorry, but you've used up another hour listening to the Best Dang Enterprise podcast. That's according to 9 out of 10 security policies. I want to thank my co-hosts for being here for this episode. Let's start with you, Chibert. I know that it's kind of warm over in Hawaii at the moment, and hopefully I'll be joining you as this episode starts. What will you be up to over the next week? Where can people find you? Where is your work being published?
Don't have anything up right at this moment, but I am actually going to be working with 65,000 volt lines, and we're going to learn how to tap them correctly without frying ourselves and try and build a power model for the University of Hawaii campus.
Oh, no, I can't see anything possibly going wrong with that. 65,000 volts? No. I mean, that's 65,000 volts of some friends.
At least I'm not touching the 120,000 volt lines.
I guess. Okay, that's one way to look at it. A man who will not be playing with high voltage over the next week, at least I don't think he will be, is Mr. Curtis Franklin from Information Week Radio. Curtis, what can people expect to hear from your radio show?
Well, not the sound of me being fried by 65,000 volts with any luck at all. What people can expect to hear is more information from those who have been nominated for the Information Week Elite 100. We're in the lead up to the Information Week Elite 100 conference that will be taking place in Las Vegas, Nevada, May 2nd and 3rd, concurrent with the beginning of Interop. Some great radio happening as we bring stories of successful projects and what they meant to the IT teams and enterprises involved via radio. Take a look for it over at informationweek.com.
Gentlemen, thank you so very much. You know it is always a pleasure to do TWiET with the two of you. Folks, we also want to thank you, the person who watches or listens each and every single week. We wouldn't have a show if you didn't drop by to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easier for you to do that. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/TWiET. While you're there, you'll be able to find the links to all of our back episodes if you want to see something that we've talked about in the past, the links that we use in our shows, as well as a place to automatically download the format of your choice into your device of choice. If you want the audio version in your phone so you can listen to us on the drive to work, you can do that. If you want a video version on your tablet so you could watch us on break, you can do that. If you want the high-definition video version on your desktop or your laptop, your Mac, your PC, you can do that. Again, that's twit.tv/twiet. Don't forget that we do this show every Friday at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time. If you go to live.twit.tv, you can find our live stream that includes the pre-show, the post-show, and everything in between, as well as all the things that get taken out of the final edit. And as long as you're going to watch live, go ahead and jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv. I do call out questions, and I look for comments in the chat room to bring into the show if you want to be part of the interactive experience that is Twit TV. Again, that's irc.twit.tv. Don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll find out who we're going to be talking to each week. You'll be able to suggest guests and topics for future episodes of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And, well, you find out what I do when I'm not in the studio. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo, who let us do This Week in Enterprise Tech, to Carson, my super producer, and this week to my my replacement TD, Burke. You know him. You love him. He's the guy that we blame for everything. Burke, thank you very much for being the stand-in TD, because the rest of the studio is sick. Until the next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiet.